Okay, good morning. This is January 31st and it's Bio 241. We're in our second week. We're kind of talking about chemistry in the middle of the chemistry chapter. So I hope you all are doing your pre-lecture reading assignment, maybe starting to work on your study guide for the exam that's coming up. I don't know when that is, but we can find it if you have a question. All right, on the slide on the left, we have Blackboard. And I had a couple questions regarding how do you get to the practice questions, the review questions, the online questions. And it's a really good question. So let's go to the weekly assignment. Okay, and let's see, how about this mouse? Okay, go to weekly assignments. Oh yeah, the clicker doesn't work on that one, so I'll use this mouse right here. Weekly assignments, and you have practice quizzes on each of these weeks right here. All right, oh, notice that the deadline for week one, because it was a short week, I extended the deadline until February 1st, which is tomorrow, and then the second week is due tomorrow night as well. All right, so those two assignments are done by tomorrow. So let's click into this week right here. So sometimes I pull some of these questions off and put them on the weekly quiz. Sometimes I pull them off and put them on the lecture exam as well. So you do want to practice these things. And sometimes you have to click on this link more than one time to get it to activate. I'm not sure why that is. All right, so let's just try clicking on this link. And really what I like to do is right-click on it and open it in a new window. You might want to do that so it doesn't display within the frame within Blackboard, but it actually displays as a web page all by itself. So I'm going to right-click and open it in a new window. All right, then I'll left-click on new window right there. And sometimes it bonks you out, and sometimes it lets you right into the practice quiz. All right, so you want to be doing the simple and difficult, but not every single question, just the ones that are in the study guide. And it worked perfectly this time. Sometimes it doesn't work perfectly, so let's go back. And so let's go back. And if the links aren't working, then here is the master link. All right, so again, open this in a new window. So open it in a new window. And you get a login page. You might get dumped into a login page, but you do not need a username or password to access these questions. Just click on resources right here, and it will take you to the menu of what chapters you want to be working on, right? So you do not need a username or password to work with this edition of the book, or actually any edition of the book. So I just clicked on it, and then here's chapter one. Here's the practice quizzes. All right, so you're interested in some of the select few sample simple quizzes questions and difficult quiz questions. All right, so you might see there's some other activities in here that you can do as well, but follow the study guide. That's the short form of mousing around through here. All right, so when you get to the login page, just click resources. You don't have to enter a username or password if for some reason it dumps you into the login password page. Okay, so anybody can use these practice quizzes. Okay. All right, so let's get to the topic at hand, which is some chemistry. Where do we find our chemistry docs at? Probably documents. Go over right here, lecture PowerPoints. What else maybe do I want to put up on the page? How about something that looks like periodic table or something like that? Ah, here's periodic table. Don't forget, you'll get a periodic table. And I think the one that you have in Blackboard is actually says periodic table on it, not just atomic masses, right? So you should really know the proper name for that table as well. You'll be given a copy during the test. Okay, so we want lecture PowerPoints right here for chapter two. And we're going to get started with lecture. All right, so does anybody have any questions on what we covered so far on chapter two in terms of chemistry? Any questions at all? No, we talked about some orbital theory. We talked about some chemical bonds. We talked about two kinds of chemical bonds. Does anybody remember what the two kinds of chemical bonds are so far that we talked about? Covalent and ionic bonds, right? And what's the best way to think about a covalent bond, just in a short form, without a really long sharing of valence electrons, okay? And what about for ionic bonds? What's a really nice short way of thinking about an ionic bond? Okay, donating. Did somebody say donating? What else did you say? Accepting electrons. Yeah, donating or accepting electrons. And again, it's going to be with those valence electrons someplace, right? So, and ionic bonds are weaker than covalent bonds. All right, so I think we kind of ended up maybe over here last time. Okay, so let's see. What I want to do is make sure my cursor doesn't disappear. It's having a tendency to disappear, so let's get it so that it doesn't. Okay, pointer options, arrow options, visible. All right, now I'm happy. Okay, my cursor's not going to disappear in the middle of the lecture. So we looked at particular sodium and chloride, and on the periodic table we found out how many electrons they had, because it's got to match the number of protons, and remember, the number of protons inside the nucleus, which we call the atomic number, is easily seen on the periodic table with a number above the chemical symbol. So you got to get busy and memorize a number of chemical symbols right here, like K stands for potassium. It's really kalium, but in English we call that potassium. Right, so there's a table in the PowerPoint slides that tells you which chemical elements you have to know. All right, and then you fill up the shells with the electrons. In order for this to be a neutral atom, the number of protons has to equal the number of protons, so you know how many electrons to fill up the shells. So in the first shell of an atom, how many electrons can you put in there?
Two.
And then the next shell, how many you put in there?
Eight.
And then that element becomes stable when you completely fill up that outermost shell, right, or the valence shell. Either put zero or fill it up completely with eight. And we built a couple molecules, right? I think we did the sodium chloride last time. We also built a water molecule. All right. And one of the other things that we talked about, when you have certain atoms, when they're covalently bound to a hydrogen, it produces a polar covalent bond, which is a little bit different kind of bond, right? Because it makes that part of the molecule soluble in water. So what are the elements that actually produce a covalent polar bond when it binds to hydrogen? Oxygen is one, right? But also don't forget about nitrogen, phosphorus, and another one I think I asked you to fill in your notes, and that is sulfur. All right, and we're going to take a look at these different bonds in just a little bit. All right, so where the heck are we? We're around here someplace. Okay. We're going to talk about hydrophilic and hydrophobic molecules. A hydrophilic molecule, so that just means it has a love for water, which means that it can dissolve in water. They're soluble in water because they readily form hydration spheres, just like these ions right here, like sodium, which has a positive charge on it, and this chlorine. It can dissolve in water because water likes to associate with this electrical charge or even any kind of partial electrical charge, because remember, the hydrogen end of a water molecule has a slightly positive charge, and it's going to want to combine with a negative because opposite charges attract each other. So the chloride ion dissolves in water very nicely. And same thing for the sodium ion, dissolves in water very nicely, because what kind of ion is sodium that you see right here? It's positive. What do we call a positive ion? A cation, right? And a negative ion is an anion. I'm not sure if I mentioned that last time. And some ions have more than one charge. Some of them might have plus two instead of just a plus one. And it's a cation. But in that particular case, we're going to call it a bivalent cation, all right? So, and what kind of ion is this chlorine right here? Let's think about that. It's not bivalent, right? It's monovalent. This would be a monovalent anion, and sodium is a monovalent cation. Magnesium forms a bivalent cation, and there's other kinds of ions that might be trivalent or whatever. All right, so I want you to know the whole terminology. All right, so monovalent cation, a good example would be sodium. A monovalent anion would be chlorine right here. Okay, and those ions dissolve very nicely in water. As a matter of fact, any kind of molecule that has a polar covalent bond with hydrogen will have a tendency to dissolve in water because they'll have a partial positive or partial negative charge on it. Okay, and those would be hydrophilic compounds. right? Glucose and some amino acids, and we're going to take a look at their structure in a little bit. These are compounds that dissolve in water because those different compounds, glucose will have oxygen molecules with a covalent bond to a hydrogen, which is polar, that will form hydration spheres around it, and it will then dissolve in water. Hydrophobic molecules only have non-polar covalent bonds throughout their whole structure. And as a result, there is no partial electrical charge on them, and they just won't dissolve in water. As a matter of fact, they won't like water very much at all. We call those hydrophobic compounds. So your body is made up of these two different universes right here, and the two different universes are a polar universe, right, which contains water, and hydrophilic compounds will dissolve in that solvent. And then the other universe is the hydrophobic universe, and that is filled up with oil and lipid kinds of molecules, which have no polar covalent bonds whatsoever, and that's a whole separate part of your body. Okay, let's look at the third kind of bond of the four that we're going to look at in here, and this is the weakest one so far. And what kind of molecule do you see right here? You see a water molecule, right? Just an H2O, and we know that oxygen forms a polar covalent bond right here, so this hydrogen is a little bit positive, this oxygen is a little bit negative. And if we put that water molecule into a container with other water molecules that you see right here, that there's a lot of structure that develops. These molecules will arrange themselves so that the hydrogen on one molecule will then associate with the oxygen of a neighboring water molecule, and that's a very weak kind of bond, and we call it a hydrogen bond. But nonetheless, water has a lot of structure even though it's a liquid. Okay, so this is what we call a hydrogen bond. And as a matter of fact, some organisms are so light that they can even walk on the surface of water. They're not heavy enough to break these hydrogen bonds. Have you ever seen an animal walking right on the surface of water? Yeah, like for instance what? Like water spiders and insects and things like that. Now, if we try to walk on water, of course, we're heavy enough. We're going to break those bonds and go kaplunk. Okay, and so this right here, hydrogen bonds between neighboring water molecules produce surface tension. So when you look at a water molecule, for instance, if we had some water spilled on the floor over here, a tile floor, you'd have to be careful because you might slip if you step on it. But that's not really a good way to think of water. Because of these hydrogen bonds, is water more slippery or is it more sticky? Actually, water is really sticky because of these hydrogen bonds, right? So water molecules do get glued together, even liquid water molecules, okay? So, and the stickiness of water, we talk about in terms of surface tension, okay? So those are the three kinds of chemical bonds. We're going to look at another kind of chemical bond called a van der Waals force a little bit later on in the class. And van der Waals force will be even weaker than a hydrogen bond. All right, so let's start talking about acids and bases and the pH scale for a little bit. And I think you start to go over some of this stuff in lab as well. An acid is a molecule that can release a hydrogen ion into solution. And another name for a hydrogen ion is a proton. And why is that? It's used interchangeably. It might seem strange to people. All right, but if you have, let's look at the periodic table over here. Here is the hydrogen element. How many protons are inside the nucleus? One. Okay, and if it was an atom someplace, it would also have one electron floating around in that first orbital or spinning around in that first orbital. That would be a hydrogen atom. And if we remove the electron away from that atom, then, of course, we have a hydrogen ion. And what is that hydrogen ion? It is just a proton that's maybe in solution someplace. And so a hydrogen ion, which is just a monovalent cation, is the same thing as a proton. And that's what we use over here on the PowerPoint slide, right? So a proton or a hydrogen ion is exactly the same thing. And an acid is a compound or a molecule that releases those things when it's placed in solution, when it's placed in a water solution. So we say an acid is a proton donor because it's releasing protons in solution. A base, on the other hand, okay, is something that can accept protons. So it takes protons or hydrogen ions out of solution. It's a proton acceptor. And I've got some examples down here at the bottom of the slide of acids and bases. All right, notice this first column right here. Actually, it's the second column. We have the chemical symbol for some various acids. And there's something that's consistent in all of these compounds right here. And you should know that S now stands for sulfur, right? And P stands for phosphorus. And you can look at the name over here, and N stands for nitrogen. Here are a bunch of acids. But if you look at the chemical formula, what is the common feature in each of these acids? You see hydrogen elements, right? Bonded to these compounds right here. And when you put these compounds in solution, this hydrogen has a tendency to jump off of it. As a matter of fact, hydrochloric acid is what we call a strong acid. And when we put HCl in water, it completely dissociates. This hydrogen completely comes off, right? So you have a chloride ion and a hydrogen ion, and they're floating around in solution. That would be an example of a strong acid. And that's a definition of an acid. When this compound is placed in water, it releases hydrogen ions into solution. Then if we look at the fourth column over here, do you see any hydrogen atoms in here? Yeah, but they're always associated with the oxygen, right? So what we see, the common feature is this OH group right here. Yeah, oxygen. Well, what did I say? Did I say carbon or something silly? Okay, so we see this oxygen with the hydrogen, so this is an OH group, a hydroxide group, and when we put sodium hydroxide into solution, the hydroxide comes off, and sodium hydroxide is what we call a strong base because it completely dissociates. Okay, and when you have that hydroxide anion, we call that a proton acceptor because it can combine with a proton from an acid, right? And what is formed as a result? If we take this hydroxide group with this proton over here from hydrochloric acid, what do we get? We just get plain old water. So though an acid and a base do neutralize each other because a base is a proton acceptor and an acid is a proton donor. But don't forget that a base produces this hydroxide anion, right, which then results in water when it's combined with a proton. So here are some names of some important bases for you. Here are some names of some important acids. Some of these are important inside your body, like phosphoric acid is and carbonic acid. Not so much for these others. And we're going to look at some of these different acid groups that we find inside our body. Okay. Next slide. So, how do we talk about pH? When you have a hydrogen ion in solution or hydroxide ion in solution, it changes the chemistry of that solution drastically. Small changes in pH change the chemistry, the chemical reactions to a large degree. And don't forget, we're just a bunch of chemical reactions taking place all the time. So we're really interested in pH. And the pH is just a way of talking about the concentration of hydrogen ion in a solution. Okay, and so the pH scale runs from 0 to 14, and the middle number from 0 to 14 is 7, right smack in the middle is 7. And when the pH is 7, there is an exact equal number of hydrogen ions and hydroxide ions in solution, and so we say pH 7 is neutral, because it's neither acidic nor basic. Okay. We calculate pH with this equation right here, which you'll have to do with your calculator. So you'll have to have a calculator with a log button in it, and there's also should be log to the base 10 because we want to use the base 10 log. There are other different kinds of bases that you can use, like natural log. You might see a log to the base E right here. Okay, and the way that we measure pH is that we take the hydrogen ion concentration, this is what the brackets means right here, in terms of moles per liter of hydrogen ions, take the inverse of it, and then take the log to the base 10, and that will tell us what the pH is. All right, so pH 7 is what? Neutral. Okay, if the number gets smaller than 7, even just a little bit, then the solution is becoming a little bit more acidic, which means that the hydrogen ion concentration is increasing, right? So the pH is just a measure of the hydrogen ion concentration. So from 0 to 7 is acidic. If that pH number goes greater than 7, then we say it is basic. So I think maybe I can, oh, I had a bunch of markers I was going to bring down. And I was even going to give your marker back to you. Rats. Okay, let's try this one.
It was there.
Oh, it was there. Okay. So let's draw up some beakers on the board right here, and then you can tell me if the solution is acidic or basic or neutral. You can't tell me what the number is, because we're not going to work it with a calculator, but you should at least be able to tell me if it's acidic or basic or whatever. So here is a solution with H2O. Okay, here's a beaker with water in it, and it's got some hydrogen ions right here. So I'm drawing some hydrogen ions. So which way is this solution tending toward now? Is it tending to be basic or acidic or neutral? It's tending to be acidic, but I'm going to change the story on you, right? I'm going to put some hydroxide ions in here, like this. Now what can you tell me about this solution right here? It's neutral, right? And this is the only solution you could tell me what the pH is. If it's neutral, what's the pH? pH 7, okay? And it's neutral, some of you students saw that, is because the number of hydrogen ions exactly equals the hydroxide ions in every particular case. And so there is no excess hydrogen ions or hydroxide ions, so this is a neutral solution of pH 7. All right, what about this beaker over here? So here we have some water, and, okay, now what is the solution looking like? Alkaline or basic, you could call it. Okay, I'll put maybe a couple hydrogen ions in here. All right, but still, okay, what do you see? More hydroxide ions than hydrogen ions, so this is a basic solution. Okay, so what could be the pH range in terms of pH numbers? It's going to be greater than 7. So it could be 7.1, 7.2, or 8, or 9, or 10, all the way up to what number? 14, right? And we're not going to calculate what it is. All right, here's another beaker with water in it. And this beaker right here, right, has what? A lot of hydrogen ions in it. Is this an acidic solution or a basic solution? It's acidic because it has a lot more hydrogen ions in it. And what possible numbers could they be? Okay, so these are going to be less than 7. So 0, 1, 2, right, 3, in that range. I'm going to erase that because I don't want that to be confusing, but it's going to be less than 7. All right, and so here we have acidic, neutral. This might sound strange when you first look at it, but with a little bit of practice, everybody gets it down, but you got to practice a little bit, okay? The strange thing is, as this solution becomes more acidic, right, the hydrogen ion concentration increases, but what about the pH number? As the hydrogen ion concentration increases, what about the pH number? It decreases. It goes the opposite way. That's the strange thing, and you just got to develop a feel for that, right? Over here, as the hydrogen ion concentration decreases, what happens to the pH number? It increases, it goes the other way. There's an inverse relationship between the pH number and the acidity of the solution, and that is due to the equation that we're working with right here. You see an inverse relationship between pH and the hydrogen ion concentration, because the hydrogen ion concentration is in the denominator. Now, if you're really familiar with algebra, you can look at this a little bit differently. If we bring the hydrogen ion up into the numerator here, then we have to put a minus in front of the log sign. So those of you that have a little algebra background, you could take advantage of that. But I have some exercises maybe in the back of the book or in Blackboard for you to calculate pH given what the hydrogen ion concentration is. And then given the pH, you should be able to calculate what the hydrogen ion concentration is, working backwards and forwards. And your lab instructor should be able to help you out. And you got to practice using your calculator with this equation before the test. It's really easy to do, but every calculator works a little bit differently in terms of when you punch the log button and when you take the inverse of something. So you got to practice with your particular calculator. And even if you were allowed to borrow somebody's calculator during the test, it might be so different that you wouldn't be able to calculate the right answer, right? So make sure you have a basic scientific non-graphing calculator for the test, the first lecture test, and practice calculating pH and things like that, okay, and hydrogen ion concentration. And if you don't get to it with your lab instructor, then I'd help you out during office hours too, okay? And unfortunately, during a test, okay, we can't share erasers, can't share pencils, can't share Scantrons, and we can't share calculators, right? So make sure you have a calculator that you know is working. And I'll turn all the lights on. If you have a solar-powered calculator, it usually works in here. But you might want to bring it in and just double-check, make sure it does work with these lights, okay? All right, so don't forget, as a solution becomes more acidic, as it's becoming more acidic, what happens to the hydrogen ion concentration? Does it increase or decrease? Hydrogen ion concentration increases, but what about the pH number? It decreases, right? As a pH number gets smaller and smaller and smaller, that means the solution is becoming more and more acidic. Okay, so a strange concept, but if you work with it a little bit, okay, and if you look at this table and do the calculations, it will make perfect sense. All right, so if we have a molar concentration of 10 to the minus 7th, which is what, 0 point, and 7 zeros, and then a 1, that's really dilute concentration of hydrogen ions, all right, and a solution that has the exact same concentration of hydroxide ions in solution, all right, what is the pH? 7, it's exactly neutral. The other thing that you probably notice is, look at the exponent to the 10th power right here. It's minus 7, okay, it's minus 7 over here, and what is the pH number? Exactly 7, right? So because the concentration can change by so many orders of magnitude, it's really difficult to talk about the concentration of these things in terms of molarity, so that's why we use this simple algebraic trick to convert it into a pH number, where the pH number corresponds to minus the exponent right here. Okay. Once you use your calculator, you see how that works. Pretty nifty. Okay. So here we see a very dilute concentration of hydrogen ions, 10 to the minus 14th. And over here, it's really, really high. And as the concentration increases, you see the pH number decreasing. Okay. All right. So I skipped one slide, but we're going to come back to it right away. If we look at the pH of blood, okay, the normal range is 7.35, 7.45. So our blood is what, neutral? It's close, but it's really a little basic, right? It's a little bit basic. So this is the normal range right here. And that's a very sensitive number. So we talked about homeostasis already. We consume foods that can be highly acidic or highly basic. If we went into 7-Eleven and got a big Slurpee filled with Coca-Cola, its pH is about 1. If we were to drink that half gallon of Coca-Cola, you might think, well, gee whiz, that could actually kill somebody for the following reason. All right, if your pH, blood pH, is 7.35, if all of a sudden your blood pH were to drop to 7.1, guess what? That probably would be fatal. So that's a very small change in pH. So homeostatic mechanisms have to keep pH within this range right here. If it drops below 7.35, we call that acidosis. If it goes above 7.45, that's alkalosis. If it changes very rapidly, even a small amount over time, that's very, very dangerous. All right, now somebody could be at a pH of 7.2 or 7.1 if that condition developed over a period of a couple weeks or a couple months or maybe 6 months, something like that, right? And they would become acidotic, for instance. All right, so why isn't it that when we have a bunch of vinegar on a salad, which is acetic acid, or drink a Coke, how come our pH just doesn't drop so much that it becomes lethal? Why is Coca-Cola not lethal to drink, even in fairly large quantities? And that's because we have buffers in our body. So I went back a slide. I didn't go forward. I went back to talk about buffers. Okay. And a buffer is another kind of molecule that resists or slows changes in pH when either an acid or a base is consumed or added to it. All right, so a buffer is a solution, and we have buffers inside our body, so we're a solution of buffers. And the job of these buffers is to prevent a change in pH whenever we consume an acid or a base. And that's a pretty important kind of concept. It doesn't mean that a buffer will maintain a pH of 7 inside our bodies. It just means that whatever the pH is of a solution, that it won't change if you add an acid or a base to it. So Buffers are molecules that slow changes in pH by combining with or releasing hydrogen ions into solution so that the hydrogen ion concentration does not change when you add an acid or a base to it. Here is a very important buffer system we find in the blood. And since it's in the blood, what does that do for the blood? It prevents changes of pH of the blood. Okay, so here is a chemical reaction. Let's take a look at this one right here. Here we have H2O. What the heck is that? That's water. Okay, that sort of looks like a zero to me, but that really should be an O, right, H2O. And then we have carbon dioxide. Dioxide means there's two oxygens on a carbon atom right here. And you might be kind of familiar with that because you're producing that all day and, as a matter of fact, all night long too, right? That's the reason why we exhale carbon dioxide. If we take carbon dioxide, mix it with water, which happens inside our body all the time, it produces another compound called carbonic acid. Right, and carbonic acid is a buffer. It can dissociate into hydrogen ion and bicarbonate. So probably you should know the names of these terms. Here's a bicarbonate ion. And what kind of ion is that? Is that a cation or an anion? That's an anion, right? Just a monovalent anion. Right? And notice these arrows with this chemical reaction right here. Is it a one-way street or two-way street? It's a two-way street. It can go back and forth. And the way that this chemical reaction works is by what we call the law of mass action. We're going to talk about that coming up sometime pretty soon, which just says that if we add a bunch of hydrogen ions to this solution, it's going to force the reaction to the left. All right, so these hydrogen ions will combine with bicarbonate, all right, and then will maintain the pH of the system, and it's going to produce CO2 as a result. Or if CO2 increases in solution, it's going to force the reaction to the right, and it's actually going to make the solution more acidic. All right, so this is sort of interesting, and you can see that this is related to respiration because we release CO2 by our breathing all the time. So if we were to hyperventilate, if we were to lose a lot of CO2 from our body, guess what would happen? It would, if the concentration in our body of CO2 decreases, it's going to force the reaction to the left, right? And then bicarbonate is going to be used up. It's going to combine with hydrogen ion to form some CO2 in our body. And our pH, what will happen to our pH if this hydrogen ion gets used up? Will it go up or down? Okay. Hydrogen ion concentration will go down as a result, which means the pH number is going to go up, which means then we become basic inside our body. And what did we call that? Okay, alkalotic. That would be alkalosis. So just by changing your respiratory rate, right, you can change the pH of your body. And some people that are hyperventilating all the time are in what we call a respiratory alkalosis as a result. Or if your body is producing a lot of acid, what is one way to get rid of that acid in your body? By hyperventilating. So every time we exhale, oh, we have very alien breath, actually. It's filled with acid, which is basically CO2. Maybe we can do that experiment in lab. We can take CO2 from our body and measure the pH as we bubble our breath through a little glass jar, and the little glass jar with water will become very acidic as a result of just breathing through it. Okay, so this buffers pH. This equation right here generally usually buffers pH, because we can adjust our respiration to help maintain pH in our body. Okay, that's another way of thinking about it. So if we hyperventilate, that would be if we just manually control our breathing and hyperventilate. But under normal circumstances, we don't think about our respiration, our respiratory rate. That's automatically helped controlled by our brain and this chemical reaction right here, which helps maintain pH in our body. All right, so that's a buffer. So what would you think of a buffer? What does it do? It maintains homeostasis in terms of pH inside your body so that your pH doesn't vary too far beyond these normal limits so that it maintains life inside your body. Okay. All right, let's look at some organic molecules. And we're going to think of two different kinds of molecules, organic molecules versus biological molecules. And sometimes they're the same, sometimes they're a little bit different. Okay, but an organic molecule, a nice strict definition of an organic molecule, is a molecule that contains a carbon atom, which is covalently bound to a hydrogen. That's the strict definition. All right, so I'm going to put some molecules on the board. What about water? Is that an important biological molecule? Yeah, because most of your body is made up of water, which is what? H2O. Now, is water an organic molecule? You see a carbon atom in there. No carbon atom, so immediately you know that it's not an organic compound. All right, we just talked about CO2. Is CO2 an important biological compound? Sure, because our body is producing it all the time. Does it have a carbon atom?
Yes.
Carbon dioxide? Yeah, it has a carbon atom, but is it an organic molecule? Some of you were thinking ahead, thinking I was trying to trick you right away, but I didn't. Now I'm trying to trick you, okay? Is carbon dioxide an organic compound? It's got carbon, but it doesn't have a hydrogen, right? So it's not organic, but it's a very important biological molecule, right? So there's a little bit of difference. What about a carbon with four hydrogens? Remember, that outer shell of carbon, if you look at the periodic table over here, the outer shell of carbon is missing four electrons, so it wants to find four electrons from somebody to share with. So it looks, and it can find electrons from four hydrogen atoms right here. That's a nice stable molecule. That's methane. Well, it's relatively stable. Okay. That's a nice molecule. Now, is this an organic compound? Absolutely, because it has carbon and it's got covalent bonds, four covalent bonds with four different hydrogen atoms right here. So that's a nice organic molecule. But is this an important biological compound? Probably that's what you came to class to learn, so you probably don't know that. The answer is no. It's an organic, but it's not an important biological compound. Okay? So inorganic, inorganic, organic, important biologically, not so important biologically. So we're going to start looking at some compounds that are, some organic compounds that are important in terms of organic chemistry. Okay. Now, if you don't see this statement right here, stop by my office hours and we'll build that methane molecule based on that orbital theory. But you should be able to do that because here is carbon, right? How many protons inside the nucleus? How many protons inside the nucleus with carbon? Can you see it on the screen right there? There's six, so it's got six electrons. How do we fill the orbitals up? The first shell has got two. That means that you have four left over to go into the outer orbital. So you got four valence electrons, but that carbon really wants eight, so it's looking for four, and it can get four from four of these hydrogen atoms to form that methane right there. That's kind of it in a nutshell. All right, so here is another compound. It's got six, see if I can get my cursor working. It's got six carbon atoms right here. And each one of those carbons is looking for four electrons to share. And this terminal carbon right here is sharing with three hydrogens, but it can also share with another carbon. So this is the carbon backbone that we find in biological molecules quite frequently. This is what we call hexane, but it's not an important biological molecule. But is it an organic molecule? Absolutely. Okay. All right, so we have some covalently bound hydrogens to this carbon backbone. What can you tell me about this covalent bond right here? Is it polar or nonpolar? What produces polar covalent bonds? Phosphorus, sulfur, oxygen, and nitrogen, and carbon is none of those. So all of these are polar covalent bonds. And because of that, because of all these nonpolar covalent bonds, this molecule just is hydrophobic and won't dissolve in water, right? Because these are all nonpolar covalent bonds. And this structure can form rings instead of just a linear molecule. It can form ring structures. And again, since you don't see any phosphorus or nitrogen or oxygen right here, this compound can't dissolve in water either because it is hydrophobic as a result. Sometimes we draw this compound, instead of drawing in all of the elements right here, we just symbolize it with this stop sign type symbol. Right, so this is no longer hexane, we call this cyclohexane because it forms this ring structure. And sometimes it can even form a special little structure that looks like this. We call this benzene, because sometimes there can be double bonds between the carbons, and if there's a double bond, then it doesn't need another hydrogen in that carbon position. All right, so these are important organic compounds, very important organically, but not so much for biochemistry. But we can change this compound by substituting some other functional groups on this carbon atom right here. So we're going to change the structure of this hexane by maybe putting an oxygen or a sulfur or a nitrogen or a phosphorus. And if we change the structure, what are we going to change? We're going to change how this thing functions, right, especially inside our bodies. And we substitute for hydrogen, we call those substitution groups functional groups, because when we change the structure, we're changing what? The function of those molecules. Okay, so let's look at the next slide. You see the, well, this one, 1, 2, 3, 4, it has five carbons. Oh, here's six over here. Okay, well, let's just pretend it has six to make it look like a hexane. Okay, let's pretend it has six. But now we're changing the function of this compound because instead of a hydrogen, now we have a double-bonded oxygen. And I do want you to know the name of that functional group right there. So we're changing this molecule, the function of this molecule. That's a carbonyl group when you have a double-bonded oxygen. Here is a hydroxyl group, right, with an OH. So an OH is a hydroxyl group. All right, now what kind of bond do we form between this hydrogen and this oxygen right here? Is this polar or nonpolar covalent bond? That's a polar covalent bond. So guess what happens now? Since this is a polar covalent bond, this part of the molecule now likes to dissolve in water as a result of it. All right, so we're really changing the world that this molecule likes to live in. Here's a sulfhydryl group. It has a sulfur atom that has been substituted for the hydrogen. We're going to see what that role that plays a little bit later on. Here's a nitrogen group. All right, so we call that amino. And then if we have a carbon and we have a double bond to an oxygen and an OH over here, we call that a carboxyl group. Now, what did all those acids have when we looked at a list of acids? It kind of stood out from all that list of bases on the other side. But what did all the acids have? I heard the right answer over here. Hydrogens, right? So here's a hydrogen, and this hydrogen can jump off of the molecule pretty easily. So when it donates, when this group donates a hydrogen ion to solution, what is this group right here? Yeah, this is an acidic group, right? So whenever you see a carboxyl group, think of an acid because it can donate that proton to solution. Okay, and then the last group right here, phosphate group. See the phosphate atom? And then we see some OH groups, and these hydrogens can be donated to solution. So this would be another acidic group right here. It can change the acidity, or it can act as a buffer inside your body. So these are organic acids because of this proton right here. And this would be an alcohol group. And then the carbonyl is just another functional group. We'll see what role that plays in metabolism a little bit later on. All right, so I do have a little exercise for you to work with. I think it's online, but we'll work with it in class so that you'll be able to recognize this as a carbonyl group. All right, the OH is a hydroxyl group. Here's a sulfhydryl group, the amino group. All right, a carboxyl group, which is an acid because of that proton likes to come off, and phosphate, that's an acid group as well. All right, and when the hydrogen comes off, all right, then the oxygen becomes a little bit of a negative charge. Here's a little bit of a negative charge, and so it can form hydration spheres around it. So this molecule then, or at least this phosphate group, likes to dissolve in water very nicely. All right, but this carbon backbone still is hydrophobic. This end of the molecule is hydrophilic. That has some important implications in terms of how organelles are formed inside our body. All right, so the last things that we got to talk about in this chapter are some of the basic important biological compounds inside our body. And most of them are going to be organic compounds. And there are four important groups. The first group is called the carbohydrate group. The next group is going to be called lipids. And then another group is going to be called proteins. And then the next group is going to be called nucleic acids, four important biological compounds. All right, so here's a carbohydrate. And here's the carbon backbone. And if we just have a carbon backbone by itself with hydrogen atoms, it's not soluble in water. But take a look at this one right here. All right, here I see a bunch of hydroxyl groups on it. And what kind of bond is formed between this oxygen and this hydrogen? It's a polar covalent bond. So even though it has this carbon backbone, sugar loves to dissolve in water. It's hydrophilic because of all of these OH groups. Every single carbon has an OH group associated with it. So you can take sugar and dump a lot in water, and it's going to dissolve right in, right, because of those polar covalent bonds. All right, the other thing that I want you to notice when you look at this is that this molecule can form a cyclic ring. So in most circumstances, sugars exist in these cyclic rings, just like you saw cyclohexane. All right, and so a lot of times we'll symbolize a sugar with a stop sign with an oxygen molecule right here on the top of it. That would be a nice example of a simple sugar. The other thing that I wanted to mention, if we look at an individual carbon, what's bound to each of these carbons, except for this first one right here and this last one, but all of the carbons in the middle of this hydrocarbon chain have what bound to it? A hydrogen and a hydroxyl group. So what do you call an H, one H, and an oxygen and another H? Water. Okay, and that's how they named this class of compounds. For every carbon, they found a water molecule bound to the carbons, and so they said, that's a carbon hydrate. Instead of saying carbon hydrate all the time, now people are saying what? Carbohydrate. So that's where the name comes from. So a carbohydrate is the same thing as a carbon hydrate, which is a carbon with basically a water molecule added to it. All right, so here is an example of glucose. Here's an example of galactose. It still has six carbons, and every carbon has an H2O on it. But notice that in this position right here, for galactose, you have a hydroxide group, but in glucose, it's a hydrogen atom. All right, so these are what we call isomers of each other. They're very similar. Their chemistry is a little bit different because that's a change in structure. When you change the structure of a molecule, you change its function. Even a small change just like that drastically changes how it functions inside the body. So glucose is an example of a monosaccharide. This is a sugar all by itself. Galactose is an example of a monosaccharide. And fructose is an example of a monosaccharide. Now you can see that there's a bigger structural change in fructose compared to glucose. All right, plants make a lot of fructose. People don't make fructose, but we can metabolize it. We can convert it into glucose and it becomes an important sugar for us. So these are monosaccharides. How would you make a disaccharide? Adding two of these monosaccharides together, okay? And that happens pretty easily, right? If we take two glucoses and put it together, we get another sugar, which is a disaccharide called maltose. If we take a glucose and a fructose, put it together, we get table sugar, which is sucrose, okay? And does sucrose dissolve in water? Yeah, because it's loaded with all those polar covalent bonds, all those hydroxyl groups, right? And if we take a glucose and a galactose, we get lactose, which is a sugar found in milk, which infants find nutrition in, right? Whenever an infant is nursing, they're getting a lot of lactose, right? So these are all just little modifications of that six-carbon sugar, right? And we put them together. Okay, and they're joined together covalently, right? Which means they're put together pretty closely with a lot of energy. Okay, we have, instead of a monosaccharide or a disaccharide, we can have a molecule that's even made up of maybe thousands of molecules of monosaccharide, in which case we call that a polysaccharide. And the important kinds of polysaccharides in our body contain only the glucose molecule. So if we put thousands of molecules of glucoses together, we get something called starch, if it's a plant that does it. All right? If we take that same number of glucoses, put them together inside of an animal, we call it glycogen. So glycogen, sometimes people call that animal starch, right? As opposed to plant starch, which is just what we call starch. There's very little difference. What's the basic building block of starch? What do you need? Glucose, right? And it's all glucose. And what about glycogen? What's the basic building block of glycogen? And it's the same thing. It's glucose, right? All right, so that's probably pretty important, because what molecule is a diabetic very sensitive to? Glucose, right? And what is starch? It's basically glucose. So somebody that has diabetes has to be very concerned about the amount of starch that they have in their diet. And what are some foods that have a lot of starch? Potatoes, any kind of wheat product, whether it's bread or pasta or tortillas or whatever, it's basically what? It's just a bowl of starch, a bowl of sugar that you're eating, because that's the basic building block. All right, so starch and glycogen contain a lot of glucose, and glucose is an important energy molecule. So these are important forms of storing energy inside your body. And plants do the same thing, but in the form of starch. And it's a way that organisms can take thousands of glucose molecules and convert it into a single molecule. And we're going to talk about osmotic issues a little bit later on in the class, and I'll just revisit a way of talking about this particular issue here, of how if you have a really concentrated solution of glucose, you can turn it into a very dilute solution of sugars by taking all those glucose molecules and converting it into one molecule of starch. Okay. All right, so how do you make a polysaccharide or even a disaccharide? So here we have a glucose molecule and another glucose. These are two separate molecules. We can join them together with this chemical reaction. We're going to look from left to right. And again, if we take two glucose, what do we get? A maltose molecule. And what happens is these two molecules come close together, and there's an enzyme that catalyzes this reaction. It takes a hydrogen from one glucose and an OH from the other glucose. And what do you get when you combine a hydrogen with that hydroxide group again? You get water. Okay, so water comes out, and then you have a nice covalent bond through this oxygen bridge that forms a maltose molecule. Okay, and that produces a water molecule. We call this a dehydration synthesis reaction when we make this maltose right here, or sometimes it's called a condensation reaction. So a condensation or dehydration reaction also produces a water molecule. And that's kind of fascinating, because water is really the solvent molecule that our body is dissolved in. Right? So not only is water the solvent that makes the solution that our body is, but it participates in many chemical reactions. Almost every chemical reaction in your body, water is a participant in. Okay, so how could you make, what's the name of a reaction that your body can take glucose and make starch out of it? What's the name of that reaction? Starting with small molecules and making a big one right here. That would be a condensation reaction or a dehydration synthesis. So when your body makes glycogen from glucose, that's a dehydration synthesis reaction or a condensation. Right? The exact same one. Every time a glucose is added to glycogen inside your body, it produces a water. Okay? So here we have glucose and fructose, two separate molecules that are going to join together to make table sugar or sucrose. What kind of reaction do you see taking place right here? Again, that's a dehydration synthesis or a condensation reaction, right? So even though we start with different molecules and make different molecules, you should see some similarity between these chemical reactions. And once evolution has figured out how to produce these molecules, then new reactions don't have to be discovered through evolution to be used over and over and over again inside your body. At least for sugars, we see right here. All right, the other thing, maybe it's on the next slide, the other thing that this reaction is reversible. Inside your body, you can take a maltose and break it down, okay, as long as you have what available? It takes water to do that. To take maltose, break it down into two glucoses, it takes water. And we don't call that a dehydration reaction or a condensation. We call that a hydrolysis reaction. Hydrolysis, hydro is water, lysis is, what does lysis mean? To break apart. So it's the breaking apart of water. Hydrolysis reaction is the breaking apart of water, because the hydrogen, one hydrogen atom has got to go to one monosaccharide, and the hydroxide group has to go to the other monosaccharide to break it down. We call that a hydrolysis reaction. So do I have that digestion of polysaccharide? Oh, it's on the slide, but I don't have the reverse direction. So the reverse direction, erase this arrow and put it over here. The reverse direction, taking glucose, converting it into two glucoses, would be hydrolysis reaction or sucrose and breaking it down into fructose and glucose. Again, that would be a hydrolysis reaction, and you would need to break water apart to do that as well. Okay, that's easily done inside the body. So, for instance, let's talk about this. Here we have maltose, and if we add more glucose molecules to it, we no longer have maltose because maltose is just a disaccharide. But if we add more glucose molecules to maltose, all right, what would we call that molecule? And how is it done inside your body? That molecule would be called, in your body, since we're animals, it would be called glycogen. And what's the name of the chemical reaction? That would be a dehydration reaction, dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay, so if you end up with glycogen, which is hundreds of molecules of glucose all joined together just in this way, so it's a big, long molecule, that's done with a dehydration synthesis, and the building block would be glucose. Okay, so this is what I wanted to get to. If your blood glucose starts to drop because you're in a fasted state, where can your body go find some glucose to put in the blood to maintain homeostasis? It's going to go find a glycogen molecule someplace, right? And what's the building block of glycogen? Glucose. And what kind of reaction would your body use to get glucose out of glycogen and put it in your blood so that your blood concentration of glucose stays within normal range? A hydrolysis reaction. That's right. And that primarily takes place within your liver. Okay? So that's the importance of glycogen, where you find it, and the importance of these reactions right here. So you make a polysaccharide by putting together what? Monosaccharides. And you got a couple examples of some monosaccharides right here. You got galactose and fructose and glucose. And I will want you to know that this right here is not an amino acid, it's not a lipid, but it is a monosaccharide. I won't ask you to tell me that this right here is galactose and this is fructose, but you should at least know that fructose, when you see this thing right here, that's a monosaccharide. When you see this thing right here, that's a monosaccharide. And here, that's another example of a monosaccharide. Okay? And are these things soluble in water? Yeah, because of all these polar covalent bonds with oxygen to hydrogen. That's some of the things that you should appreciate. Okay, the next class of compounds we call lipids. Lipids are insoluble in water because water is a polar solvent, right? Lipids are hydrophobic. They don't want to have anything to do with them, okay? They consist primarily of these hydrocarbon chains and maybe some rings, but these compounds don't contain oxygen or phosphorus or nitrogen or sulfur, okay, to a large extent. So let's take a look at some of these compounds right here. This is what we call a fatty acid. Here I see second fatty acid. Here's a third fatty acid. So here is a long hydrocarbon chain. These are all nonpolar covalent bonds. So this part of the molecule does not like to dissolve in water. And then if we look at the tip of this molecule, we see a carboxyl group. All right? And this carboxyl group is very reactive because it's an acid. And it helps partially allow this molecule to dissolve in water because of this polar covalent bond right here. Okay, and just like in that sugar reaction that we looked at previously, if there's another molecule around that we call glycerol, here's a glycerol molecule, and you see how many carbons does glycerol have? It has three. Glycerol is not a fat, okay, because it's not just a hydrocarbon chain, it has a hydroxyl group at each of these positions. And notice that this hydroxyl group can come off and join with this hydrogen right here to form a water molecule, not just in one position, but in each of these three positions, can bind three different fatty acids. And when that happens, what do we call that chemical reaction when water is produced? That's a dehydration synthesis reaction or condensation, exactly like what we saw for sugar molecules. All right, but now we get this really nice molecule that has three fatty acids on it joined to this glycerol molecule, and we call that a triglyceride. Probably we've all had a blood test where they measured triglycerides inside our body, which is what? Just three fatty acids joined to glycerol right here, because that's an important indication of the health of our cardiovascular system and metabolism. Okay, don't forget to turn your cell phones off during class. Okay. Okay, so how does your body make a triglyceride? What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? Would be three fatty acids and a glycerol molecule. And it's pretty easy to get a glycerol molecule because if you take a glucose and snip it in half, guess what you get? You get two glycerol molecules because glucose has six carbons to them, right? So that's what I want you to appreciate. Now, if your body needs fatty acids for metabolism, there's a lot of energy in these covalent bonds between the carbons right here, can be metabolized to make ATP. So you have a triglyceride in your body. How do you get fatty acids out of a triglyceride? A hydrolysis reaction. Take three waters, break them apart, right? And then break these covalent bonds right here, and you end up with three fatty acids, which can be used to produce ATP, and a glycerol molecule. Okay, so just like for that carbohydrate metabolism, you can go in the forward direction with a dehydration synthesis or go in the reverse direction with a hydrolysis reaction. Okay, here are some specific examples of fatty acids. Fatty acids have different names depending on how many carbons they have in this backbone. So look at this big, long hydrocarbon chain, which is not soluble in water, but it has a little carboxyl group that helps. This is palmitic acid. But what I really want you to see on this slide is the difference between saturated and unsaturated fatty acids. Every carbon right here has a single bond, okay, and two bonds to two hydrogen atoms. Since every carbon is completely saturated with hydrogen atoms right here, we say this is a saturated fatty acid. But if for whatever reason we find two carbons with a double bond between them, which means then they're going to be missing one hydrogen, we call that an unsaturated fatty acid. Okay, so here is an unsaturated fatty acid because we see a double bond right here, and so it's missing these hydrogen atoms. This is an example of linolenic acid. Okay, and the metabolism of these things are totally different, right? Unsaturated, saturated fatty acids have important health implications, so you should at least know have a picture in your mind of what the difference is between a saturated and unsaturated fatty acid. This one is also a little bit longer, has a little bit longer chain to it. Okay, so there are different fatty acids have different numbers of carbons and different positions for these double bonds to make them unsaturated. Nonetheless, it's still a fatty acid. These things can also form bends. Okay? And we'll look at that, I think, on the next slide. All right, phospholipids. It's still a lipid, but it's kind of an amazing sort of lipid. What I want you to recognize is here's that three carbon, and I see an O here and an O and an O, oxygens, and if it's not bound to something, that would be an OH group. So what do you call a molecule with three carbons with these three functional groups in these three positions right here? What is that thing? That's a glycerol molecule, right? So that's a building block of a triglyceride. But glycerol is also a building block for a phospholipid. In this particular case, the first two positions have a fatty acid attached to it. How would you attach a fatty acid to a glycerol molecule? Dehydration synthesis reaction, right? Dehydration synthesis here and here. And now in the third carbon atom, we have a phosphate group. You see the phosphate atom right here? So this is a phosphate group, right? Now what can you tell me about this phosphate group right here? Okay, it's polar, right? So this end of the molecule does not like to dissolve in water, the end that has fatty acids, but this end of the molecule, because of this phosphate group, has a tendency to dissolve in water. Right, a couple more carbon atoms, and then a nitrogen group. And what is this nitrogen group? It produces polarity. So this end of the molecule really likes to dissolve in water. So phospholipids are kind of a magic molecule. Half of the molecule likes to dissolve in oil or lipids, and the other half likes to dissolve in water. We're going to have to bring that up again a little bit later in the course. Okay, so This right here, the part that does not like to dissolve in water, what do we call that? Hydrophilic or hydrophobic? That's the hydrophobic end of the molecule, and this is the hydrophilic end of the molecule. And sometimes we just draw it out like this. It looks like a little guy with a head. Sometimes we call that the polar head group on a phospholipid, and then this is the nonpolar tails, okay, on a phospholipid. Okay, we haven't talked about cells yet in this class, I don't think, but we have an anatomy. Okay, oh, what did I want to say? I forgot what I was going to say. It will come back to me. All right, so let's take this phospholipid right here, and let's see how magically it works, and then this is the last thing that we get to talk about today. Okay, but let's go back to a beaker. Actually, not a beaker. Let's take this thing right here. So first, we got to identify this thing. What is this thing right here? And there's some fluid in this bottle right here. And then all of a sudden we see another line right here with some different fluid down over here. And on the top of the bottle, we've got some oil. And down in the bottom of the bottle, we got some water. All right. And you got this in your refrigerator. What is that thing right there? That's like a salad dressing bottle. Somebody saw that. Amazing. You're reading my mind. Okay. So here you have oil. Here you got water with all the spices and good stuff that make the salad taste good. Okay. And you pull it out of your refrigerator, and it's separated exactly like this. Okay. Now, did you have to do something really special to get it to separate out like that? Or does it happen automatically? Happens automatically. As a matter of fact, if you want these things mixed up, like before you pour it on your salad, what do you have to do? You got to shake it up, right? You got to mix it all up. Otherwise, it's going to go back to this thing, and you just don't want to pour oil on your salad, okay, because you want some of this good stuff down over here. All right, so these two layers form automatically. Now, let's take that phospholipid. What does that phospholipid look like? It looks like that. What is this right here? That's the polar head group. Right, here is the hydrophobic tail, and we drop that molecule into this bottle. What is it going to do? Okay, and I suppose you could shake it up, but you probably don't even have to shake it up. Is it going to move around someplace? Where is it going to go? It's going to go, I got to turn the mic down just a little bit. It's going to go so that the hydrophilic head group, which is this part right here, is going to end up in the water part. And what about the hydrophobic tails? They're going to go up into the oil, just like that. And did you have to do anything special to take that one molecule and stick it exactly right there? That's pretty precise, but what? It just happens automatically. Okay. Furthermore, instead of just one, let's just say we take 1,000 of these phospholipid molecules and dump them in the bottle right here. What's going to happen? They're going to all line up just like this, okay, with the hydrophobic tails pointing up. All right, just like that. And they're going to be really happy. That's a nice stable solution. If you want to disrupt that solution, you got to shake the bottle up. All right, but now, furthermore, what the heck, all right, does this kind of look like now in terms of biology? This thing right here, that looks like a membrane. So membranes have the ability to self-assemble themselves. They build themselves based on the physical chemistry of this molecule right here. The phospholipid molecule is the basic building block of all membranes inside your body, and membranes just like to build themselves automatically because of the nature of the hydrophobic part of the molecule and the hydrophilic part of the molecule. Okay? So I do want you to study this structure. If I show you this structure on the test, I do want you to tell me that it's a phospholipid because it's what? Like the basic building block of all life. Right? So it's important for you to be able to analyze the structure, know this is the hydrophilic part and this is the hydrophobic part. And where we're going to start lecture next time is, okay, with actually making a cell, okay, which is the next slide. All right, there's a sign-in sheet going around. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Anybody who's not on that sign-in sheet is not registered in the class, which means then you got to see me, okay? And make sure you're registered. Oh, one last thing. Don't forget, deadline. Deadline every Wednesday night at 11 p.m.
Hi.
I have a question to the lab for the teaching of the worksheet.
For your lab instructor?
Yeah, because I went to the course on my gateway.
Yeah.
And then I went onto the my gateway, but I only have the lecture folder. Where can I find the lab
folder? I'm not familiar with the lab folder, but let me get out of here and get into my gateway and see. When do you have your lab?
Right now.
Oh, okay.
Well, luckily I emailed him. He attached it and I got to clean it out.
Oh, yeah. Ask him in lab. He'll be able to show you. I'm not familiar where he puts things.
Oh, okay. So I should ask.
Because the only thing is it's not in Blackboard because I didn't put it in there. So it's probably in Gateway.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know where it is.
Oh, it's
a different, yeah. Yeah, it's different than Blackboard.
I was logging on Blackboard the whole time.
Oh, yeah. It's in your gateway someplace.
Okay,
when you find out how, show me, because I would like to find it too.
All right, I'll let you know.
I know at the beginning of the class, there's a lot of mousing around, but once you get it, it's nice. It's handy to have everything.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Hi. Did you register? Good.
But
what? You can't stay in the class, or what?
I like it.
Okay.
Coming Thursday.
Yeah?
Actually, I'm a nurse. So I have to work Wednesday 11 to 7 and Thursday 3 to 11. So in the morning I have to sleep for 4 hours.
If I want
to go to work, I
cannot
come here.
To lecture?
Okay,
that's bad.
But that's
because I might have to drop you if you miss a lot of classes.
Oh, this is first time.
Okay. Yeah, it's important to come to class.
What time is your lab?
Because they're like building blocks. Farah, don't leave. I'd like to talk to you, okay?
No, only take time.
Don't do it too many times.
No.
And never miss a lab because you have quizzes in lab that you can't make up. Okay. Okay, so one time I won't get my feelings hurt. Okay, but you have to come. Have your supervisor call me. Oh, yeah. Who's got the sign-in sheet? I don't know where the sign-in sheet is. Is this the sign-in sheet? Nope, that's not the sign-in sheet. Maybe it's in, is it stuck in the back? Did anybody sign the sign-in sheet? Anybody here? You did.
Yeah, I was in the back.
So it's going around or somebody took it with them. Uh-oh, you're going to be counted absent if you don't sign it. Let me look. Sometimes they put it right here. No sign-in sheet here. I'll have to walk up the aisles and see where the sign-in sheet is. Or if someone wants to take a quick walk up there while I erase all this stuff. Next question. What's this? Adam, that's you. That's nice. Oh, yeah. Okay. I will complete this and send it over. Is that good? Is that how we usually do that? Or do you carry it over yourself? I think I can do it right away. I don't have a pen with me, though. You find a pen? Okay.
I'm not officially in the class.
Oh, that's too bad.
The code and stuff. Because I wasn't initially in the class.
Yeah.
What's the last time, day, whatever, I can add?
Today.
Today?
Yeah.
Because I have that.
Yeah, because the deadline is tomorrow. And if you register today, you won't have access to Blackboard until tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah, there's one lab I was wondering only had it. So you're not on the sign-in sheet. Ah, here it is right here, so you're not on here.
Yeah, I
did. But you signed on the bottom. Yeah, now sometimes students don't register for, you know, like financial reasons or something, and we have a foundation here that can give bridge loans out, like buy textbooks and stuff like that. So if that's the only thing hanging you up, then I would run over there and talk to them. Yeah. Foundation, yeah. Which is even different. That's up on like the fourth floor above the DSPS office. So Cypress College Complex, you can take the elevator up all the way to the fourth floor.
Okay.
Found it.
I got it.
I don't know. I'll use a pen.
Okay.
Lalita, let me have your pen. But I'll give it back to you.
Nice. Okay. Out of room. That's okay, they know what I mean. Cool, Adam. Got it. So, just talk to me before the exam sometime. So I don't forget. Good. Hi.
I already took the online quizzes, yeah? But one of them I know is right, and it keeps on telling me it's wrong about the control group.
Really?
Yeah. And then another one, I forgot what it was now.
Okay.
Does it too. Like, I'll go back and try, because I was trying to doubt myself, so I went back and
yeah, yeah.
The other ones,
yeah.
And it kept on coming up wrong, so whatever I did. And then another one.
Is it, could be made, was it a multiple choice one, instead of just one choice? Maybe it's two choices? I don't remember putting any questions like that in there.
Only one choice.
Okay. Because the ones that have one choice, you just push a little button.
Well, yeah, that's what I did.
Okay, and then the ones that have multiple choices have a little square.
Okay, there was no square.
Okay. And then you could actually click too. But here, if you push a button, all the other ones go blank.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. You want to see me like right after, like right now, and we can look at that quiz?
Sure.
Because I don't have a class at 1. Do you have a class at 1?
No, I don't.
Okay, we'll look at it.
Okay.
Yeah, first person, though.
Yeah, no. Mention that. Well, I want to get it done early, so.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's take a look.
Okay.
I maybe don't want to do it. It's right in front of class. So maybe we have to just go to my office or something. Okay. Next. Yeah. It won't correspond to the study guides. Because they change the chapters around sometimes. They change the questions at the end of the chapter. They change the figures within a chapter. And on the study guide, I tell you, I want you to know exactly figures 1, 5, and 7. And then they scramble that around, and so then you won't know what figures to study. But you can get away with the previous edition. If you go to the library has a current edition, and see how it corresponds to your book. The content is exactly the same. They just shake it all up. So that it's not exactly the same book. It's exactly the same book, but it's not exactly the same book. Okay, so it's easiest if you buy the current edition. The current edition also has the study guides in it. The figures all printed out, so that's a little cost savings, because it does cost you to print the figures out to practice them, and you gotta practice those figures.
Also for the quiz, you have to email it right?
It's automatic. But some modules in Blackboard, it says you do not have to submit assignment to instructor. So that you don't have to send to me or anything. It's only the very last page of the weekly modules, which is the quiz. And that automatically gets sent to me. Actually, it gets automatically entered into Blackboard. If you would like a demonstration, then come by my office hours or something.
Okay.
Like before a lecture.
So every time we practice, it automatically goes to
you? You know, it just goes. It goes nowhere. It's just for your learning. The practice quizzes are just for your learning, but I might take some of those questions and put it on the test, the lecture test in class, and then that's where you would get points for it. Okay, so it would be like a practice test, but there's only one online quiz. It's the very last page every week. All those other exercises are just for learning, just to practice over and over and over again. Okay, welcome. You signed in, right?
Yay.
Okay. Oh, you know what?
I
lost something.
No, you have.
have it. I don't. You know, I didn't. When I got home, I saw it, and I thought, oh, I'm a goofball. I'm sorry.
No, I. Oh, how nice. Okay.
Exactly.
Oh, I'm all right. Sorry. Oh.
Because it was
okay.
Open.
Yeah, I was. I was. Yeah, I thought I lost it because it was open.
No,
okay.
But if you would have lost it, I could have gained it because
okay.
I already have this.
Yeah.
But I got home and
yay.
I said, oh my Lord, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's good. Okay. Well, so there's still a lot of fun to be had.
And it's just, although if you could go online and get the address, but
yeah.
It's just five stops.
Okay.
And call where you exist.
Okay. Really good. That's fun. See you. Okay. Study hard. Good morning. Good afternoon. Good day. Micro. I'm jealous of Micro. Yeah. They have really nice labs. You have good labs in Micro. Okay. Because you can break all kinds of cool stuff and whatever, all that. Yeah, that's a possibility. One of these days. Change my major. Okay. Okay, I'm free to go.
Okay.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. How
good.
Are you?
I'm good.